This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're flying this holiday week, I hope you're on a flight that serves more than pretzels, and that if you're stuck at the airport, it at least has some shops and restaurants to help you kill time. A good book might help. My guest Walter Kern has written a new novel called Up in the Air that's a satire about airports and airplanes and the airlines that control every aspect of your life when you travel. Up in the Air is about a business traveler who virtually lives in what he describes as Air World and has come to feel most at home there. His ambition is to earn 1 million frequent flyer miles, and he's close to achieving it. Walter Kern is the literary editor of GQ and a contributing editor to Time and Vanity Fair. Let's start with a short reading from Up in the Air.
Planes and airports are where I feel at home. Everything fellows like you dislike about them, the dry, recycled air alive with viruses, the salty food that seems drizzled with warm mineral oil, the aura-sapping artificial lighting, has grown dear to me over the years, familiar, sweet. I love the Compass Club lounges in the terminals, especially the flagship Denver Club with its digital juice dispenser and deep suede sofas and floor-to-ceiling views of taxiing aircraft. I love the restaurants and snack nooks near the gates, stacked to their heat lamps with whole wheat mini pizzas and gourmet caramel rolls. I even enjoy the sweet hotels built within sight of the runways on the ring roads, which are sometimes as close as I get to the cities that my job requires me to visit. I favor rooms with kitchenettes and conference tables, and once I cooked a Christmas feast in one, serving glazed ham and sweet potato pie to a dozen janitors and maids. They ate with me in rotation on their breaks, one or two at a time, so I really got to know them, even though most spoke no English. I have a gift that way. If you and I hadn't hit it off like this, if the only words we'd passed were, "That's my seat," or "Done with that business week," or just "Excuse me," I'd still regard us as close acquaintances and hope that if we met again up here, we wouldn't be starting from zero as just two suits. Twice last October, I sat in the same row on different routes as 1989's Miss USA, the one who remade herself as a Washington hostess and supposedly works nonstop for voting rights. In person, she's tiny, barely over 5 feet. I put her carry-on in the overhead. But you know some of this already. You fly, too. It just hasn't hooked you. You just don't study it. Hey, you're probably the normal one.
That's Walter Kern reading from his new novel, Up in the Air. Walter Kern, how did you start studying airline culture?
A few years ago, I was on a plane upgraded to first class for some unknown reason, and I sat down next to a businessman. And to make conversation, I asked him where he lived, and he said, well, right here. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And it came out that the man had no home. He traveled on business and lived from hotel to hotel, and airplanes and airports, as in the book, were really his turf. And I asked him after a while how he managed to live like this. Wasn't it depressing and so on? And no, he seemed satisfied and even happy with his life. And after I got off the plane, I thought, now, what kind of life would that be? And over the years, I sort of filled in the blanks, and the result was this book.
Well, you've kind of defined a whole culture as Air World. Describe the culture to us.
Well, Air World is that conglomeration of places that are no place, including airports, the hotels that are just off the runways that serve them, the rental car counter, the whole sort of attempt to satisfy the flyer's needs without any particular offense or any particular flavor. I mean, in Air World, you can come from Dallas, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, or New York and know where you are, know what's on offer, know how to get it, and what you're going to get.
And you write that the hometown papers of Air World are USA Today and the Wall Street Journal.
Exactly. Everything is standardized. Everything goes down easily. It's as though the only restaurant in the world were McDonald's and the only hotel in the world was a Holiday Inn. And, you know, people have to be able to rest and feel comfortable and feel at home at any moment, at any time. And the result has been this kind of placeless place that I call Air World.
One of the things I found interesting of your whole description of Air World is that in defining this culture of Air World, you've taken one of the more alienating contemporary experiences, flying, an experience in which everyone is a stranger to each other on the plane and everyone is uncomfortable, and you've turned it into this community. I mean, it's not really a community, but, you know, for the purposes of this novel, it's become this, like, anti-community community.
Well, it is a community. I mean, human beings are amazingly adaptable. You bring in a new technology or you force people to live in a new environment, and they find ways to do it. And my character has made friends with the people who, you know, sell the juice at the counter, the person who gives the little chair massages in the terminal. He knows the flight attendants by name. I talked to a traveler once who said, I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was flying too much when I walked through the Minneapolis airport and found myself waving to everyone.
Do you fly a lot?
I fly probably twice a month. Journalism brings me out of my Montana home out into Air World pretty regularly. And it's a place, Air World is a place that shows up in high relief when you live on a Montana farm.
Which is where you live.
Exactly.
Right.
It couldn't be more foreign and more alien. And, you know, when you talk about it being an alienating environment, one of the thoughts behind the novel was, if a man's going to have a nervous breakdown, and in a way that's what this book is about, what is the worst place he could possibly have it? And I thought, on a plane, in an airport, you're already halfway there to psychosis.
And what brings you halfway there to psychosis?
First of all, I think the lighting.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's sort of like what they say about Las Vegas. You never know what time it is. In fact, someone once posed a riddle to me, what time is it in the Denver airport? And I said, well, you know, whatever time it says on the clock. But he said, no, there are people there who came from Europe that morning and people who are just in from another time zone. And the lighting shows no sign of weather, sun, or whatever. It's, you know, it's always, it's a little eternity in there, a kind of a hellish little eternity.
Right, right. I managed to read your novel Up in the Air while in the air in my Air Flight magazine on the same day I was reading your book. The back page, I was shocked. It had an ad for enhancing your breast size and another one for male virility enhanced guaranteed. I thought that was were kind of shocking for airline magazines.
Well, that's an odd syndrome. I think when people get on planes, they start to think about improving themselves. They start to think about and get reflective and meditative about where are they going in life? What are they doing in life? And they're prey to these ads for, like you say, you know, breast-enhancing creams and vocabulary-enhancing tape courses. And you'll see those magazines are often aimed at businessmen who are insecure about their negotiating skills, and there will be an ad for a seminar on negotiating or whatever. I think people get a sense of possibility when they're on a plane, even romantic possibility, wondering if the perfect person is going to sit down next to them or something.
Now, although your main character lives in Air World and seems to have kind of bonded with their airline culture, he also realizes he hates the airlines. The main airline in your novel is called Great West, and your character says, for years, Great West has been my boss, my sergeant, dictating where I went and if I went, deciding what I ate and if I ate. Tell me about writing that sentence and writing that sense of how if you fly a lot, you feel like the airline really is controlling your life, well, even you when know, you can go to the bathroom.
Air travel is infantilizing. You're totally dependent on often unseen people, you know, the pilot behind that curtain up front. What's being served, you don't know until you sit down. And for the sort of high-powered people who do a lot of business travel, it's a curious thing. They're usually so in control and so powerful in their lives and used to ordering people around. And here they're really being told where to sit, you know, what kind of beer they can drink and when they're getting there or if they're getting there. And I think that breeds a strange sort of bitterness and resentment and hostility. You know, you see these flare-ups of air rage in the news nowadays, and it's no surprise. They're like the way infants rail at their parents. You're so powerless in that environment.
One of the things about airports that your character does not like is the art. A lot of airports now have like little art displays as you're leaving the gate. And the strangest one I saw was a collection of Madeleine Albright's brooches.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where was that?
I can't remember which airport it was.
Well, you know, it's a strange challenge these airport designers have. They have to find things that are diverting to the average person, the sort of common denominator American, and they have no idea. So they put out things like Secretary of State's brooches and strange abstract art that's sort of not particularly compelling to anyone, but not offensive to anyone either.
My guest is Walter Kern. His new satirical novel is called Up in the Air. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Kern. His new novel is called Up in the Air, and it's about life in the air and what Kern describes as air world. Now, your main character is a career transition counselor, which he describes as a fancy term for coaching people to understand job loss as an opportunity for personal and spiritual growth. What's his job like, and what do you know about that kind of work? You're a writer, so you're not in that corporate world.
Well, you know, what do writers know about anything? Only what they pick up off the ground, really. This is a real profession. These people, these career transition counselors, come in when a company is downsizing, and they immediately take in hand the discharged executive and attempt to convince her or him that things aren't so bad, they shouldn't sue the company, no, they're not being discriminated against, and here's the way to find a new job. And they sort of coach them through the process, hoping against hope that the person won't become despondent or angry or whatever. And it's a real profession nowadays. And I've seen these people operate, actually, at some of the places I've worked, some of the magazines I've worked.
And why did you want to give this job of career transition counseling to your main character?
Well, I mean, because he's in a kind of limbo personally and in the way he lives. And his job is really to make limbo tolerable to other people. He's found a special sort of talent in himself, which is to feel comfortable not knowing where he's going and in between places. And so it's natural that that talent would come out in counseling people who are in between jobs, in between stations in life. It's a job that he comes to loathe, but it's a job that he's especially suited for.
Your character looks at a lot of advertising, you know, through television and magazines. Mm-hmm. And he says, I know of no pleasure more reliable than consuming a great American brand against the backdrop featured in its advertising, like swigging a Coke on the beach in Malibu. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you know, since you write for magazines, you've written for New York, for Vanity Fair, GQ is where you are now, you've written for Time mm-hmm. magazine, your work is always surrounded by the kind of advertising you're describing there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I in a way wanted to create a character who's comfortable with all the things that the intelligentsia in America is not comfortable with, i.e. the, you know, vast and oppressive consumer culture. And he's a guy who, for whatever reason, accepts what comes to him and feels comforted by being part of the mass market. I think that's an emotion that people suppress. In America, we're constantly surrounded by these pitches and appeals and product images. And though they put us off a lot of the time, at certain times we feel sort of privileged and secure because they're almost like mantras or recurring dreams. And this guy's made his peace with the kind of commercial culture that a lot of us poo-poo.
Because your character is surrounded by this culture of advertising and franchise food and how-to cassettes and self-improvement mm-hmm. stuff. Did you have to immerse yourself in some of that, too, just so you could get all the language right?
Yeah, I did. I mean, we're immersed in it anyway. Really, all I had to do was notice how immersed I already am. Once you're alert to it and not filtering it out, it's sort of the air you breathe. And this was a book that really came about not through doing research or digging, but through waking up to the fact that I lived in this sort of miasma of messages and images, which I often felt superior to and ignored. But suddenly I decided to wake up to it, sort of like Andy Warhol became comfortable with the cannibal soup can. You know, it wasn't as though he'd never been to a supermarket. He just suddenly looked at a supermarket and went, wait, art can happen here too.
So what were some of the things that started to strike you as interesting instead of filtering them out?
Well, one thing that struck me about Airworld is that it's a class system in a way that most of America isn't. We like to think of ourselves as a democracy and egalitarian, but you get to Airworld and there is a rating and a level for everyone. You know, you see the cards they whip out at the ticket counter. I'm a gold medallion member, or I'm a gold medallion member plus, and that entitles me to XYZ. And there are all these distinctions being made out there between types of people and better customers and, you know, the kind of pillow you're going to get, or whether you'll get your glass cup or your plastic cup. And that class system in Airworld I found interesting.
Oh, it's so true. And they even call it class. I mean, it's like first class or coach class. I mean, you know what class you're in and what privileges that class allows you, or what miseries you're in store for.
Well, I mean, the higher classes sort of allow the miseries to abate somewhat, though not disappear.
Well, shrimp cocktail will do a lot to abate misery.
And, yeah, exactly. And people cling to those little perks when
That's
they're
right.
traveling in a sort of horribly pathetic way. You know, I've noticed that the few times I've traveled first class myself, you've already got your drink and your coat has been taken by the time the rest of the passengers file on. And it's hard not to feel sorry for them. They're sort of trooping past you like cows to slaughter, and you're sitting there in your, you know, wide body seat. And the funny thing about that class system is it's not really based on money. You know, some of these guys don't make more money who ride in first class. They just fly a lot, and so the airplane, you know, the airline puts them up. And so it's the one time in their life they get to feel on top of the heap, and they take it for all it's worth.
You know, I used to really envy the people in first class because I figured, God, these people have so much money, they could afford those absolutely absurd ticket prices for first class. And then I realized, no, they're using frequent flyer miles. And I started feeling sorry for them because I realized sitting in first class means you're flying so much that you've racked up enough miles to be able to sit there.
Exactly. And my character is nothing if not obsessed with accumulating frequent flyer miles. In fact, I think it's where he draws his self-esteem. You know, when it goes up from 800,000 to 900,000 miles, he feels that much better about himself and his place in the world. And once you're immersed in that world, they do become a kind of a status symbol. I can't tell you how many conversations I've heard between people sort of comparing miles in a my dog is better than your dog sort of way.
The narrator of your story tells his story as if he was addressing the person sitting next to him on a plane. Do you strike up conversations on planes with the person next to you?
Well, I did for purposes of researching this book, but in general, nothing horrifies me more than to be seated next to a talkative, vibrant person who won't let me read my magazine. And I think that's a kind of nightmare for a lot of people. But my character is sort of a worst-case scenario in that way. He has no other human contact than the people he sits next to on planes, and so he has to bond with absolutely everyone.
Oh, and he's thinking, maybe the woman in 3B is my soulmate.
Well, you know, in the old days, we had this romance of shipboard travel that you got on a ship and sort of went first class, and you were bound to find a romance or love somewhere along the way. Well, he has that attitude toward airplanes, and you know, in a sense, everybody's single when they're on an airplane, especially if they're not traveling with their family. Everybody's sort of, it's the great singles bar in the air. And this guy looks at it that way.
Walter Kern, his new satirical novel is called Up in the Air. He'll be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Walter Kern. His new novel, Up in the Air, is a satire about airports and airplanes and the airlines that control every aspect of your life while you fly. Kern is also literary editor of GQ. Now, you've been living on a farm in Montana for about 10 years. Do you think you could have written this novel if you were living in New York and advertising was all around you 24 hours a day?
And no, not really. You know, when I leave my farm in Montana, which is overrun with antelope and wild birds and wild grass, and I get onto an airplane, the contrast could not be more stark. It's like almost traveling through time. And I think a lot of the details that I write about in the book popped out at me because they're so absent in my daily rural life.
Why are you living that daily rural life?
It's easier to write. It's easier to think. And I don't have to spend time in traffic, waiting in lines, shuttling the child from playgroup to playgroup. It's just so much more accommodating in terms of time to live a little bit in the middle of nowhere nowadays.
Do you ever feel like you're a creature from another planet in your community?
Yes, I do. I mean, I live in a community in Montana which has a history of transience. It's a railroad town. All kinds of people came through that town. You'll see their pictures on the wall of the restaurant from way back, you know, Charlie Chaplin on. And so it's a very accepting place and doesn't ask a lot of questions. And that I make my living in New York or writing journalism for places like Time is not ever really remarked on. It's sort of a secret I carry around with me, and we all agree not to talk about it. But I can feel a little different from my farmer neighbors, for example, yeah.
On the other hand, you did grow up part of the time on a farm in Minnesota. Your father was a lawyer, but also had a farm?
Exactly. My father was a man who decided at some point in life that he was going to drop out of the modern world and become as close to Amish as you can without taking the vows. And we farmed with horses and lived out really far from the Twin Cities where he worked. And I guess it was part of that whole 70s back to the land movement. The problem was that only the children had to stay back to the land. He went to a corporate office every day. And, you know, in the book, Ryan also has a rural background. You know, he's come up in a very stable, very rooted place, and he's moved to a very transient and very very ever-changing atmosphere. And I think there's a mournful quality to the character because he can't quite get back to that sense of rootedness and simplicity that he originally felt in life.
As someone who grew up on a farm somewhat removed from the throbbing of American pop culture, how do you feel about bringing up your own kids on a farm that's removed from it? Because you write so much about pop culture.
Well, I feel great about raising a child shielded from American pop culture. You know, it's a drug out there, and you never know which drug a child's going to fall for. Will it be the Barney drug or the Britney Spears drug or the nonstop violence drug? And I'd rather impose myself between her and that world. When I was growing up, pop culture seemed to be less intrusive, but it was certainly out there. And I remember the first time I, you know, heard a pop record album, probably 12 years old. Until then, I'd been insulated from that kind of thing. And it hit me like a fork in the face. It was so powerful, so vibrant, so slick. And I've always felt a little vulnerable and hypersensitive even to those images. And I fear for my child, to be honest.
Walter Kern is my guest, and his new novel is called Up in the Air. And it's what it's about what he describes as air world, that kind of airplane and airport culture. You are not only a novelist, you're a book critic, and you've been reviewing books for how many years?
Oh, probably about eight years regularly.
And you're still doing it?
Yeah, now and then, but a little bit less than I used to. My appetite has decreased slightly.
You wrote in a recent piece that when you started reviewing books, a friend who was a writer gave you this advice. He said, every time you write a bad review, you'll be hurting people in your own field. Also, what goes around comes around. Watch out. The next time you publish your own work, they'll be laying for you.
Yep.
So what is it like as a book critic to have a novel coming out, and this isn't your first, and to get a taste of your own medicine, so to speak?
Well, I'd like to say, as I've heard other people who are critics say, oh, from being a critic, I know that reviewing is a bunch of baloney, so I don't even bother to read the reviews, or if they're negative, they don't touch me. Well, that's just not true with me. I'm a human being, and to me, writing and writing criticism are like playing a sport and also being a referee in that sport. And when you're a referee and you've got the referee's uniform on and you make the calls, you think, now, don't these people realize it's absolutely necessary that we have guidelines and someone calling fouls and so on? And then when you're playing the sport and the referee makes a call you don't like, you're outraged. And that's how it works for me. I mean, when I get a bad review of my book, or one that I think doesn't understand it or slights it in some way, I'm hurt. It doesn't feel good. And writing criticism of my own has not numbed that sensitivity.
As a book critic, when you read a book, you're reading it and thinking about what works and what doesn't in the plot and the writing. You're reading it very analytically. Does that ever get in the way as a writer, that analytical approach to reading?
Absolutely. It's terribly inhibiting to be a critic who writes. I end up reviewing my own book as I write it, and that's a very bad habit to get into. You know, I'll get to the end of a page of fiction and think, well, you know, a little weak, strays from the theme, dialogue is fuzzy, nobody talks that way, and I've broken my own momentum. I really have to set aside that critical part of my brain in order to write at all. Have to pretend that I'm sitting alone on a beach, struck by inspiration.
I think for a lot of writers, there's this kind of bargain that you make. I'm going to sit down and force myself to write for 2 more hours, and then I'm getting out of the house, and I'm going to a movie, or I'm going to the bar, or I'm going to a friend's house, or I'm taking a train and going someplace. I mean, whatever it is that you need to convince yourself you're going to do in that 2 hours when you're free. Living on a farm in a comparatively remote area, what do you do for that part of the bargain?
Well, to get away from my work, I irrigate alfalfa. I go out and I make little dams on little ditches full of water and run the water across the hay and watch it grow, which couldn't be further than sitting at a desk. Unfortunately, because I live on a farm, I'm able to go huge stretches without thinking about anything else but work. And when I was writing this book, I found myself at times becoming so swept up in the darn thing that I didn't have a conversation about anything else but airports for 6 days. There was no one to stop me.
Well, who would you talk to about airports?
Oh, myself. Really, just myself. I'm one of those writers who keeps everything absolutely private until the book is finished. I don't want to hear anybody's suggestion or anybody's reaction. It'll break the spell. So I go into a very strange, narcissistic dream world and try not to let it shatter for as long as possible.
Since you brought up airports again, let me share one of the things that really bothers me about flying. Tell me if you experience this. You know how about 15 minutes after the meal is served and eaten, suddenly, like, intestinal gas starts wafting across the plane, and you're stuck in this plane of strangers inhaling it, and there's no place to go, and you don't want to be thinking about, well, who's responsible for this? and so you just, no one says anything. No one ever says anything, and everybody's just kind of quietly inhaling.
Yeah. In terms of passing gas, airplanes are a no-fault environment. Everybody has to be willing to assume guilt and yet not attribute it to others. I mean, one of the things that's so horrible about traveling is that, you know, we're thrust up against each other's biological selves. You know, we may all be dressed for business, but we're, you know, our stomachs are rumbling and we have to go to the bathroom. Heck, I feel embarrassed every time I have to stand up and ask my seatmate to move his knees so I can go to the bathroom, especially if I do it twice on one flight. I can't tell you how many times I've sat there thinking, I already made him move once. Yes, I have to urinate terribly, but I don't want him to think I'm ill or have a problem. And so I just, you know, sit there clenching every muscle until we're let out into the terminal.
Well, Walter Curran, what a lovely note to end on. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Walter Curran's new satirical novel about air travel is called Up in the Air. This is Fresh Air.